This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 78th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm psyched to have with me today, Jacob West. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Gary. It's good to be here.
Jacob West is Director of Software Security Research in Enterprise Security at HP. He was a key member of Fortify's Security Research Group before the HP acquisition. Jacob co-authored Secure Programming with Static Analysis, along with Fortify co-founder Brian Chess. The book is part of the Addison Wesley Software Security series, which I edit. West is a frequent speaker and a world-recognized expert in software security. He recently co-authored BSIM4 with Sammy Miguez and myself, which we released on Tuesday. And Jacob has dual degrees in French and computer science from UC Berkeley. He lives with his partner Jonathan in San Francisco. So thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. And just to tack one more onto that list.
Oh, yes.
Now CTO for Fortify Products.
Oh.
Enterprise Security.
Well, you better update your web bio, because my spiders didn't find it.
Hard to keep every identity in sync.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Or condolences, as the case may be.
Exactly.
So you started at Fortify as an intern, saw the early days, grew to a reasonable size, and got bought by HP. Tell us about that ride and the way the company culture changed over the years.
Wow, that was an incredible ride. So my internship at Fortify started off with me coming straight out of an undergraduate program at UC Berkeley.
You were one of Dave Wagner's students, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I was lucky enough to work on a project called MOPS at Berkeley, which was with a professor named David Wagner and another guy who was doing his PhD at the time named Hao Chen, who's since gone on to be a professor at UC Davis.
Mm.
And this was one of the early applications of static analysis to the security problem and really to solving it at large scale, trying to analyze, you know, real-world systems.
Yeah, David's fantastic.
Absolutely. You know, really takes the edge off that academic tradition of working on things that are totally impractical and really tries to work on things that are useful to the world. So I had an opportunity to work on that project, and the last paper we published before I graduated was about our experience applying the MOPS tool to the Red Hat 9 Linux distribution, and in particular all the packages, C and C++ packages that ship with that distribution.
Wow, how many lines of code was that?
That was a little over 100 million lines of code.
Holy
which at
cow.
The time was one of the largest applications of static analysis for security in terms of scale.
Uh-huh.
And that got me really excited about what the industry applications of static analysis might be. And right around the same time, I got a cryptic email from a guy named Brian Chess, who said, "We have this security company. It's in stealth mode, so I can't tell you anything about it. But David Wagner said we might want to talk to you."
Yeah. That was before it was called Fortify.
Yeah, before it was called anything, exactly.
Yeah.
And so at the time, I wasn't looking for a job. I was planning to go do a PhD somewhere. Mm-hmm. I was pretty deep into that process. Brian was convincing enough that I decided to go down and meet the guys that were starting Fortify.
It was about 10 of them at the time. So easily derailed.
It's true, you know, shiny objects, right? We technologists are predictable creatures.
All right, so you get hired as an intern. There's like six guys in the office. What next?
Yeah, so the whole company interviewed me in one day, decided for some reason to bring me on as an intern. In retrospect, it was good because I'd worked on static analysis before, but at the time I didn't realize how valuable that was to them.
Right.
I came on board for the internship, spent about 2 weeks working with, honestly, the smartest, most hardworking group of people I've ever come in contact with. And that was coming out of an undergraduate program at Berkeley, where I was surrounded by people who were much smarter than me.
Yeah, but way too liberal, I think, definitely.
And at the end of that 2 weeks, I wrote to Brian, who was my supervisor at the time, and said, "Hey, let's talk about that full-time job again." You know, I was really convinced by the people, by the technology, by the problem space they were trying to address, and it just seemed like the right project at the right time.
And so what year was that?
That was 2004,
okay.
Spring 2004.
So fast forward to, 2008, then what?
Yeah, so between 2004 and 2008, I basically built up a security research group at Fortify. One of the early decisions we made in structuring the company was to have security research separated and with separate management from the people that were building the software tools.
Mm-hmm.
So security research really got a lot of attention and focus. And so in 2008, I was managing a team of probably six or eight researchers focused exclusively on delivering updates to Fortify's products around security content, so around the rules or the kinds of problems that the tools look for.
Right. And around that time, how many employees did Fortify have?
Fortify was probably in the range of 100 employees at that point.
Right. So fast forward to acquisition time.
So fast forward to acquisition time, that research team was expanded, was really formalized around supporting the different product lines, so static products, runtime products, took on increasing responsibility for things like reporting and other kind of collateral product content that comes with the products.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, the company had probably grown about another 100%, so we were just shy of 200 people, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly we were still operating the way we always had been. I mean, the model of, you know, focusing on the security user, focusing on delivering a consistent stream of security content out of the research organization was one that really served us well.
Right. So the company culture was generally speaking the same, and then HP bought you, and then what?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say the company culture was identical, right? Companies, as they grow, do change. We need more process, more formality around things.
Yeah, mental management. But you just wonder what they do, but they seem to do stuff all day.
But, you know, the growth from a 10-person company to a 200-person company can't possibly prepare you for the difference between a 200-person company and a company the size of HP, you know, well, 300,000 employees.
Do tell.
Yeah.
There must be a form for that.
What I have to say, though, is I think even to this day, so coming up on 2 years post-acquisition, uh-huh. we have done a really good job within the Fortify product group of keeping the same kind of culture, the same kind of innovative, fast-moving culture that we had prior to the acquisition.
Yeah, that's good.
And the number one thing that's allowed us to do that is the formation of the Enterprise Security Products Business Unit, which combines Fortify with the acquisitions of ArcSight and Tipping Point.
Mm-hmm.
And because we've got this little beachhead of security products within HP, we're able to control a lot of the culture and the way the organization works for us in a way that we wouldn't be able to influence the rest of the company.
Okay, let's say somebody said, all right, Jacob, you have to make a decision, startup versus big giant company. What does Jacob say?
You know, there are huge benefits to both. So personally, I think working in a startup is a lot of fun. People that like getting things done and personally contributing with their own, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, startups have a lot to offer, and you can really get a great sense of accomplishment from that.
Uh-huh.
The number one thing I think a big company has to offer, especially a company that's a big IT player like HP, is the podium, the reach to the user, right?
Right.
I can say things about enterprise security as a CTO within HP ESP that I could say as a Fortify representative, but people probably wouldn't listen to me nearly as well as they do now that I'm speaking with the voice of HP. So that reach and that megaphone, I think.
You like the power.
Absolutely.
I love it. So as a trained computer scientist, what can you tell us about technical trade-offs that you make or you had to make to cause a tool to be widely adopted?
So a lot of people that focus on security and focus on analysis for security, static analysis in particular, are focused on doing a very good job of analyzing the program, finding vulnerabilities with very high level of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that I got started at Fortify, most of the academic applications of static analysis for security to date had been focused on doing just that, doing a very precise job of analysis, but thereby limiting themselves to very small-scale applications.
Mm-hmm. Because they had such large memory and resources.
Yeah, absolutely, because the analysis they're doing is very complex, and it takes a lot of computing power to do so, especially for a large, complex program, right? What I think MOPS did a good job of and what Fortify kind of took as a foundational decision for the company is that, you know, if it's not practical on real-world systems, if you can't perform whatever the analysis you're interested in performing is on a million line or a 5 million line application, the kind of applications that big enterprises and ISVs use today, then no one's going to get any real benefit out of it.
Right.
To benefit the community and to benefit security overall, you not only need to be able to find vulnerabilities, but you need to be able to find them in places that matter and show them to people in a way that allows them to act on them.
Is that just an incredibly clever way of saying you have to dumb the thing down?
You don't necessarily have to dumb it down. You have to make it accessible to people in their environment. So if you're speaking to a developer or you're speaking to a security tester or you're speaking to a QA engineer, the kind of information they need to be able to act on your results is very, very different. And
okay.
So tuning what you show to the right person, I think, matters a lot.
Man, you're good. Did they put you through PR training?
Oh, just once or twice. I hope none of it stuck, though.
Yeah, I'm afraid it stuck, Jacob. So what are the key challenges that lie ahead for static analysis from a technical perspective?
From a technical perspective, the shift away from the code describing the entire behavior of the application is a trend that's a real challenge for us. So increasingly, applications depend on third-party code that isn't written by the organization. They depend on configuration files and annotations and all kinds of external stimuli that affect how it's going to behave and how it needs to be secured. They increasingly depend on business logic and code that's executing on the client side and therefore is untrusted. And basically, static analysis is really good at simulating what a single code base is going to do.
Right.
And understanding what that code base plus a bunch of configuration plus annotations plus external stimuli, how that's going to behave, is increasingly challenging for static analysis. So a lot of the technology that we're focused on improving our analysis of is around these expansions of the program's behavior outside of its code alone.
Are the academics working on that you know of?
You know, I don't think so. I think the academics continue to focus mostly on precise analysis. And the ones that I'm most interested in these days are ones that are trying to combine static analysis with runtime techniques to get more precision or more accuracy.
Right.
So they're trying to take the benefits of the breadth of simulation with static analysis and the benefits of provable results with runtime testing and combining those two.
I think provable is a little strong, but I know what you mean.
Demonstrable
results.
Yeah, much better word.
Yep. So what are the key challenges that lie ahead for static analysis culturally?
So one of the really interesting things that the BSIM project demonstrates, that we've all known anecdotally in the security community for a long time, but I think it's great to have raw numbers behind, is that the central security group, the software security team that's trying to manage software security for an organization, is less than 2% the size of the developers and the rest of the organization that they're trying to manage.
Right.
And I think the single biggest challenge for solutions like HP Fortify and for software security tools, broadly speaking, is how do you continue to enable that very small group of experts with accountability for solving the problem? How do you enable them to reach out to and leverage, you know, the development organization that is, you know, 50 times their size?
Right.
And that, I think, is where a lot of our technology energy goes and where a lot of the work in the industry around education and developing good governance processes is really focused.
Yeah, I think that, you know, sometimes us geeks get a little wound around the axle from a technical perspective and forget about all of the cultural changes that go along with a large-scale software security initiative.
Yeah, I mean, I like to talk about, you know, people, process, and technology are the three components that are required. And I came to Fortify because I thought technology was really interesting and really well-suited to solving this problem. I could not have been more surprised by how much more important the people and process piece of that picture is compared to the technology side.
Oh, man, and I was always an anti-process zealot, and here I've gone and built this BSIM thing. So
wash your hands. Dude.
Yeah.
Wash your hands.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So when Brian Chess quit security, I'm using that loosely, you took on his role as co-author of the BSIM to help us produce BSIM 4, which was released last Tuesday in September 2012 when we're recording this. What did you learn about the project that you didn't know before?
So I always knew that the project, from listening to you over the years, I always knew that the project was very much based on let the data lead us where it will, right? Let the data speak for itself. And we're not going to impose any conclusions on the data. We're going to let the data tell us what's important. And I think watching that sausage-making process unfold or participating in that sausage-making this time through really proved to me just how valuable that core basis of the project is and how really exciting it is to be working on a project that helps the industry understand such an important area in a way that is so data driven.
Mm-hmm. Because we really need some data in our field.
Yeah, I mean, artists are a great thing, and we need artists. We need to keep having artists, but we need some scientists too.
So BSIM4 describes the work of about 1,000 full-time software security group members in 51 firms. Do you think that as a collective, those 1,000 people are approaching software security properly as a discipline? In other words, we're gathering all this data, but are the people that we're looking at doing the right sort of stuff?
I certainly think so. You know, from an anecdotal standpoint, I look at the people that participate in this project, and I look now in much more detail, having contributed as an author, to the specific activities that they're undertaking, and I see them really representing the best in the industry today, you know, really the people that are at the forefront of solving the software security challenge.
Cool. I have to agree. So why is having a measuring stick for software security initiatives a valuable thing?
I think primarily because of this problem that I already alluded to, which is the difference between art and science. You know, software security has basically evolved as we know it as a field in the last, you know, little more than a decade. Mm-hmm. And in that time, a lot of really smart, really inventive people have solved a lot of incredibly challenging problems with a combination of technology, process, and the right people to participate. With that said, many of them solve those problems in different ways. As you would expect, people plugging along kind of in a vacuum, working on their own to do, but many of them have also converged back in on activities that are common to many of the organizations that participate.
Mm-hmm, mostly by being constrained by the realities of enterprise security.
Right. You put smart people in a similar problem space, and they're likely to come up with similarly optimal solutions. Makes perfect sense.
So one of the cool things I think that resulted from the BSIM that I never would have anticipated is we asked these people what they wanted, and they said, well, we want to meet each other.
Yeah.
And so we got them all together, and it was sort of like long-lost brothers meeting each other, you know, after being separated at birth.
Absolutely, and those events are just incredible. I mean, the magic in the air is palpable. But I tell you, so giving people that, you know, that soft measuring stick of being able to talk to their peers, maybe within a vertical, about what they do, but also the hard measuring stick of seeing, you know, quantitative data about what other people like your firm are doing and being able to hold yourself up against that and draw a comparison, I think, is immensely valuable.
Mm-hmm. So the BSIM activities emphasize the importance of focusing some attention on flaws at the design and architecture level and not just bugs, which is what we look for with static analysis by and large. Do you think as a field were over mesmerized by the bug parade?
I certainly think if organizations get too caught up in, you know, kind of mundane day-to-day bugs, any one of which is not going to bring the organization down, they might underinvest in finding the really serious flaws. I think that's definitely a risk. At the same time, you know, a lot of the public-facing damage organizations receive today around security is around these stupid little bugs that people take advantage of and then use to embarrass the organization in some way. Mm-hmm. So I think trying to get that bug parade under control is still a very valuable effort and one that we should continue to invest, you know, a great deal of energy in.
Yeah, so the question is should we abandon the bug parade? I have to agree with you there. I just think that because we're getting pretty good at finding bugs using tools and better processes, that we sometimes lose track of the fact that that's only half the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Just because we've solved the easy part of the problem doesn't mean we've solved the hard part, too. It means we've freed up the people that used to solve the easy one to work on the hard one instead.
Right. And so the next question is, any thoughts on automating architecture risk analysis?
So this has actually been a hot topic within our research organization this year. You know, I don't think we have the solution to it yet, but I think if we can start to give people a framework to relate the vocabulary used in different parts of the security world, right? So use the vocabulary that we use to describe vulnerabilities, to describe threats, to describe countermeasures, then we could start to give people a better framework for conducting risk assessments. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we'll ever automate it all, but if we can give them better input to the problem space, and a better way to write down what they perform as part of solving the problem, then we may be able to help them. I don't think it'll ever be automated in the sense that static analysis for bug detection is automated,
right,
but we might be able to speed up the work that a human has to do quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. So you wrote a book for the Software Security Series. Thanks for doing that. How was it? Would you do it again?
That's a great question. So it was, I would say, the single most formative experience of my life. It's certainly the thing that I am most proud of having ever completed, and the thing that was hardest for me personally.
More than finding the fossilized possum?
You know, tearing down your chicken shed is a fun way to spend a weekend, but probably not the most challenging thing I've ever done. The book, on the other hand, boy, that was tough. I never thought of myself as someone who liked writing. For the year or so after we finished publishing it, yeah. I absolutely said, no, I would never do it again.
See, you forget. That's what happens. That keeps happening to me.
Yeah, the pain fades, right? And you just start to remember the positive stuff.
Right.
But also, you know, the reason I did it and the reason I was excited about it was I had some stuff in my head that I thought the world could use hearing about, right, would be useful to hear about. Mm-hmm. And I think if I had that situation again, I would certainly consider publishing on it as well.
Mm-hmm. So, change of channel. One of the current flavors of the day is mobile security. So what's the deal?
So I've been focusing, one of the benefits to being one of the longest standing Fortify folks left at HP is I get to work on pretty much whatever I want to. And for the last year and a half, I've been thinking a lot about mobile security. The way I look at it, there are basically two problems that enterprises like the ones that we talk to have to deal with. One is, how do they keep their employees and their customer or sensitive data safe on their employee devices? Right, so they've got people bringing their own devices in from home. They've got company-issued devices. How do they keep that fleet of employees safe? And that's one problem.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is enterprises are now trying to reach their customers using mobile applications to extend their existing web or other online presence through mobile. And so HP Fortify is most focused on that first problem. That's an extension of the existing enterprise software development security problem, right, which is now we've got this other flavor of application. How do we keep it and the ecosystem that it operates in safe? I'm personally interested in the bring your own device problem as well, and how do we start to apply some level of software security to the applications on those devices or to the application distribution points that those devices are acquiring their applications from, you know, e.g. app stores and marketplaces.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that side of things is much less well figured out today.
So how goes static analysis for iOS/Objective-C or Android/Java/C++?
Yeah, so Android, we've supported static analysis for more than 2 years. That was the first platform we built support for.
Because you guys were, you know, pretty strong Java shop, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a strong background in Java. Android applications are written in Java, although they compile into a different bytecode, obviously. That made it an easy starting place for us because basically the security researchers already had the technology necessary to start analyzing those apps.
Mm-hmm.
We also subsequently have released support for Objective-C and iOS application analysis. Generally, I'm really excited about the space because I think there are a lot of fairly straightforward mistakes that developers are making that static analysis can do a really good, consistent job of finding.
Oh, good Lord, like the mini SQL or whatever that thing is called.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, you see the same kind of SQL injection mistakes or the same kind of buffer overflow mistakes.
I thought we killed that 10 years ago.
10 years ago, 20 years ago with buffer overflow, right? This is not a new problem.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of trivial mistakes that we can help find. But I'm also excited about the space because I think there are opportunities for doing the kinds of more heavyweight or more precise analysis that academics would like to apply across the board. I think there's a better chance to apply some of these techniques in the mobile space because of the scope of the applications, because they tend to be much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in the next few years, we're going to see increasing innovation around or innovative analysis techniques around these mobile platforms.
I sort of thought that about the smart card space when I was working in you know, the mid-90s on that stuff.
Right.
In the late 90s, because the 8-bit microcontroller, you know, mini version of Java, gosh, this is easier to analyze.
Yeah, now you just need every consumer in the world to have one, and then it would be...
Everybody in Asia-Pac seems to have one.
Yeah, that's true.
So can you highlight the differences in app communication between iOS and Android and why that matters for security, please?
Yeah, so in iOS, applications can't communicate with each other. That's the fundamental rule. In Android, applications can easily send messages, and in fact, the Android architecture, kind of the way they propose people build applications is often that a single app is in fact segmented into multiple components that are communicating with these messages or intents, as they're called. And I think this is a fundamental, you know, architectural decision that has a big impact on security. I'm not sure, frankly, what all the details of the impact are going to be yet, but I think it's going to be an interesting area to watch.
So you don't have an opinion about who has a better design or fundamental philosophy there?
I think Apple certainly makes it much easier for themselves and much easier for developers. Now, the trouble is that things that are easier are often less powerful, and I think many in the development community are going to appreciate the power and flexibility that the Android platform gives them. Mm-hmm. Now, which one of those is going to result in better market share or a better business for the mobile companies, that's really hard to say.
No, we'll have to just leave that to the lawyers, I think.
It'll be fun to watch, that's for sure.
So, final app or mobile security question. Should users really decide what capabilities an app can have?
This is a great question, right? So this has to do with users being desensitized, you know, getting this long list of permissions asked of them. Do they want to grant, you know, these 12 permissions to the application? In the Android case, they have to either say yes or no at a blanket level. You know, a logical derivation of that would it be better if they could say yes or no in a fine-grained way? I think generally users don't want to know about this stuff. They don't want to know about their security. They don't want to know about threats that new applications might bring or what those applications are asking for.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if we just let people install arbitrary apps from who knows where with who knows what security, we're going to be back where we were in the 90s when the Internet and the web was taking off and people were downloading malware without thinking about it or running executable attachments to email.
Yeah, you know, when Java 2 came out, like right about 1998, I think,
right.
We started writing about it, and you know they had all of this fancy capability stuff built right into Java 2, which of course nobody used at all. And Felton said it best, I think. He said, given the choice between dancing pigs and security, users will pick dancing pigs every time.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're not going to not download an app, right? You went to download it, and now it's saying, hey, if you want me to run, I have to do this. Who's going to say no?
Well, absolutely, right? You've got saying yes between you and playing Angry Birds. Everyone's going to say yes, right? There's no question. So I fundamentally think that the right place to address application or software security for mobile devices is at the distribution point. So I think the people that control our app stores, and in the future, I think we're going to see more diversification of app stores. We're going to see more enterprises hosting their own app stores that their employees are required to download, you know, internal applications from.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that distribution point is where we're going to see software security start to be introduced as a differentiator. So we're going to see some equivalent to a star rating for security on app or a risk threshold for app.
It's hearkening back to the AOL's walled garden, though. We're just like getting right back in the wall.
Yeah, I think that's possibly true, and I think this is a place where Apple may have an early advantage. If they decide to adopt security as a differentiator, as a market driver for them, they've got a controlled ecosystem already where they could start to apply that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last question. French and computer security?
So I transferred to UC Berkeley, and I started off at a little liberal arts school on the East Coast where my mom is a social work professor. And at that school, there is a foreign language requirement, so everyone has to take a foreign language. I tried French for mine, and it turned out I really enjoyed it. I had a great professor who really loved teaching the subject, and when I made the decision to transfer to Berkeley, I decided that if I didn't go ahead and major in it, then there was no way I was going to carve out any time from the computer science program to learn French.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I did. I signed up for it as a double major, never expected to actually use it in my career, really just did it for fun, and that's what it turned out to be.
So are you using it anymore?
Very little, but I tell you, if you drop me in Paris by the end of the week, I'll be pretty comfortable again.
Don't throw me in that there briar patch, eh? So you and I have shared some really superb meals together in San Francisco and Athens and Frederick, Maryland. What's your next foodie target?
Oh, that's a great question. My next foodie target is actually at my house. So I've been conducting what I would say is a great experiment in growing tomatoes in San Francisco.
The tomatoes with no sun experiment.
San Francisco is not known for our warm or sunny summers. In fact, it's usually cold and foggy. And I've got some 8-foot-tall tomato plants at home with about 120 fruit on them that are just about coming in. I think I'm going to be eating ripe tomatoes by the end of the week. So,
dude, I'm coming to visit. Can I come over on Thursday?
Absolutely. All right. Have the sea salt and the olive oil ready to go.
Cool, because my tomatoes are shot at home. Well, thanks very much. This has been fun.
Gary, it's been a pleasure.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August 2012 issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on internet infrastructure. The Silver Bullet interview features our conversation with Randy Sabbat. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.